From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bob Dole won the Iowa caucuses last night by a narrow margin and with low voter turnout. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the results in Iowa with Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne, author of Why Americans Hate Politics. And we'll talk about his new book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Also, these boots are made for walking. We pick up our discussion with Nancy Sinatra. We talked with her in December about her father Frank Sinatra on the occasion of his 80th birthday. Now she'll tell us about her own recording career. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews I'm With Stupid, the new release by singer Amy Mann. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole heads to New Hampshire as the frontrunner in the Republican presidential race following his win last night in the Iowa caucuses. He picked up 26% of the vote, calls it the first step to victory. Pat Buchanan was not far behind with 23%, says it makes him the one conservative who can win the nomination. Lamar Alexander was third. He predicts the race will come down to Dole and him. There were six other Republicans. The voting process gets underway today in Colorado for that state's March 5th primary. UPI's Dick Kelsey has details.
The ballot lists eight Republicans and two Democrats, but some of the candidates may pull out of the race by primary day, depending on how they do in upcoming primaries. Political analysts predict three or four Republicans will still be on the ballot by primary day, and they caution that an early vote could go for a candidate who will have dropped out by the race even before the votes are counted. Recent polls show Colorado Republicans prefer Kansas Senator Bob Dole, who won yesterday's Iowa caucuses. Commentator Pat Buchanan stole the show with his strong second-place showing in Iowa, but he has no campaign organization in Colorado. Dick Kelsey, Denver.
Two Bosnian Serb officers suspected of war crimes in the former Yugoslavia are in The Hague after a flight from Sarajevo. The Dutch capital is the site of the UN War Crimes Tribunal. A spokesman for the court is promising a quick decision on whether to indict or free the two. The BBC's Paul Wood reports.
Eyewitness reports say that the two Bosnian Serb officers were hustled out of their Sarajevo jail under a heavy guard of French IFOR troops. Their heads were bowed into flak jackets, obscuring their faces, but the Bosnian government identified them as General Jukic and Colonel Kuzmanovic. A senior Bosnian Serb official said the men had been arrested simply because of their high rank, and their extradition to The Hague was illegal. He called the move a bad omen for the peace process. But the Bosnian government says its own war crimes center has detailed evidence against the two men, in particular General Jukic, the commander of the Bosnian Serb Army's supply corps. It will now be up to The Hague to examine that evidence and decide whether or not to press charges.
Paul Wood in Belgrade. White House spokesman Mike McCurry said today President Clinton would respect financier Felix Roentgen's decision to withdraw his name from consideration for the number two spot on the Federal Reserve Board. McCurry said the president admired Roentgen's work and was disappointed that politics had entered into the decision on filling vacant spots on the independent Fed board. Roentgen had asked to have his name withdrawn from consideration in the face of rising opposition from the Republican-controlled Congress. The Labor Department reported that workers received the smallest increase in wages on record last year. Salaries and benefits rose 2.9% in 1995. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 12 points at 56.1207. This is NPR News. A top French nuclear expert says France's nuclear tests were a big success. However, he says it will be several months before France pulls out of its sites in the South Pacific. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The French official in charge of the test, Jacques Bouchard, said the explosions would allow France to renew its strike force in two decades without further testing. He said they would also allow France to switch to simulated tests on computers. He didn't say when France would be able to start simulated tests. He said first the government has to buy a powerful computer from the United States. Bouchard also promised that the government would cooperate with nuclear experts from the International Atomic Energy Agency, who are going to the French testing site to check for radiation. He expressed confidence that they wouldn't find any. France has staged 140 underground tests in the South Pacific in the past 30 years. The government says the radiation stays trapped in cavities in the atolls. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The White House announced today that Italian President Oscar Luigi Scalfaro will meet with President Clinton April 2nd in Washington to discuss peace efforts in Bosnia. Scalfaro, whose country holds the chairmanship of the European Union, will also talk about security, human rights, and economic and trade issues in Europe. American envoy Richard Holbrooke said today the nations of Central Europe should not expect membership in the NATO alliance unless they settle their long-standing border disputes. During a brief visit to Romania, Holbrooke told reporters that NATO's expansion is aimed at creating stability in a region that had been the focal point of the two worst wars in history. Holbrooke said it's high time those countries resolve their differences. In particular, Holbrooke urged progress on a treaty between Hungary and Romania. Hollywood Oscar nominations. 10 for Mel Gibson's Braveheart, including one for Best Picture. Apollo 13 is in second place with 9 nominations. Babe and Sense and Sensibility are in third place with 7. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherry Gross. In his book, Why Americans Hate Politics, E.J. Dionne tried to make sense of the growing cynicism, apathy, and even anger expressed by so many voters. We invited him to look at the results of yesterday's Iowa caucuses. Dionne is a syndicated political columnist at The Washington Post. He has a new book called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Bob Dole emerged the winner by a narrow margin in Iowa. Patrick Buchanan came in a close second, followed by Lamar Alexander, Steve Forbes, and Phil Graham. I asked E.J. Dionne what he thinks the lead story is here.
Well, I think the lead is probably the fact that fewer than 100,000 people voted, and that this campaign has been abysmal. It is the most negative campaign I have seen in a primary, I think, ever, you know, in my lifetime. The second lead is that the Republican Revolution that we talked about so much last year was really not much to be seen in Iowa, that Bob Dole, the incumbent leader in the Senate, won but barely hung on. Phil Graham, who is the purest of the revolutionaries, came in fifth. And that Pat Buchanan, who has been sounding when he talks like economics, like Ralph Nader in attacking corporations in Wall Street, came in second, a lot stronger than people thought. So I think it's a sign of some kind of turn in our politics, what happened out in Iowa.
What turn?
Well, I think it's a turn, first of all, away from simply arguing about the balanced budget. When people wake up in the morning, they don't talk about how do you balance the budget on CBO numbers and that sort of thing that we've been talking about so much for the last year in Washington. I think that the central issue that Americans are concerned about has to do with living standards and a link between, if you will, moral issues and economics. And I think that the Republicans for a long time had been trying to define moral issues very narrowly in terms of almost a Christian coalition agenda about family values. But liberals really weren't talking about morality very much, and so they were leaving it to the Christian right. I think now people understand that the economics and family values, for example, go together. And if somebody is asking themselves the question, am I working hard enough to support my kids, or am I working so hard that I don't have time to spend with my kids and teach them what I think they should learn? Well, that's about economics and it's about morals. And I think Pat Buchanan does this message and this idea very differently from the way I would do it. And his ideas are very different from mine, but I think he has found a way to talk to that nexus in a way that almost no other candidate has.
You said that the low turnout is very significant. Do you think that the low turnout reflects the theme of your previous book, Why Americans Hate Politics?
I think that the low turnout is in part a reflection of just how nasty the campaign was. I mean, negative campaigning, if it's about real issues, can at least be informative. This is trivial negative campaigning. The kind of ads Forbes ran, for example, against Dole, whether he voted to increase Senate pensions or not, which in fact he didn't. And I think voters just didn't like that. And here you had a Republican Party whose members were poised for a real debate in 96. They thought they were on the upswing. And suddenly they discover these guys hammering at each other in a way that a lot of voters out there found disgusting. I think the second thing is that you just don't have enthusiasm in the Republican Party today the way you had in 1994. I think in 1994, you had a Republican Party that really disliked President Clinton, that really disliked the Democratic Congress, and they were motivated to get out to vote, and that's one of the reasons they won that election. You don't see that out there now, and I think that's one of the things that happened out in Iowa.
Now, why do you think Dole had such a lackluster performance in the caucuses?
Well, it's funny because in a lot of ways you look at all these Republicans and you say Bob Dole is probably the most plausible president of the lot. I don't think very many people would wake up at night worrying if Bob Dole were president. That's his greatest asset. But what you also have a sense of is that Bob Dole doesn't make people feel great. He doesn't make them excited. It's sort of safety, but not much more than that. And that gave him a lot of trouble in motivating voters. I think the other problem Bob Dole has had is that he started out this campaign saying that the way I got to win this is not let Phil Graham get to my right, and I've got to be loyal to the revolution in Washington. And suddenly the revolution in Washington just completely lost all its steam. And so the kind of campaign Dole anticipated having to run turned out not to be the campaign most relevant to voters when the caucuses came around.
What do you think Lamar Alexander did well? You describe him in a column today as Dole Light.
Right. He's Dole Light in the sense that, like Dole, he has quite a lot of government experience, indeed probably more than he likes to own up to sometimes. But he has not been so engaged in Washington that he can be easily tarred for that. In fact, he's trying to run as an outsider with the flannel shirt. I think the other thing is almost classic in political campaigns, where you have lots of other candidates dumping mud on each other, and the candidate who manages to stay out of the fight sneaks up the middle. And it's very interesting that Buchanan was, to a significant degree, disengaged from a lot of the negative stuff, and so was Alexander. So I think when people went to the caucuses, a lot of people who might like Bob Dole and respect Bob Dole said, I don't think he can win. Alexander seems fresher. And I think it's significant that the exit polls showed that one of the most important reasons people voted for Alexander was simply that he was a candidate who could defeat Clinton, which still, for a lot of Republicans, is the highest priority.
E.J. Dion is my guest, political columnist for The Washington Post and author of the new book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Pat Buchanan did very well, came in second yesterday in Iowa. What do you think he is doing that's winning votes right now?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think the first thing is we still have not had a mass participation primary where lots of people vote. He won in Louisiana, where the turnout was anemic. In a state with 4,000 precincts, there are only 42 polling places. In Iowa, as we said, the turnout was very low yesterday, so that somebody with a very committed following can do very well in low turnout caucuses. Pat Robertson did very well in Iowa in 1988. And I think that over time, Pat Buchanan has convinced an awful lot of the religious conservatives that, in fact, he can make a showing. That Bob Dole was hoping that if the contest came down to him and to Steve Forbes, the religious right would come to him not out of enthusiasm, but feeling that he was closer to them than Forbes. As Forbes started fading and as Buchanan started winning these victories, I think a lot of the Christian conservatives said, hey, we can make a really strong statement if we give Pat Buchanan a big vote out of here. And I think that's what they did.
What do you make of the crescendo and diminuendo of Steve Forbes?
Oh, that was nicely put. I don't think he's over yet. As Jesse Jackson once said, God isn't finished with him yet. I think that on the one hand, you had a problem for Steve Forbes in Iowa because caucuses still require a lot of organization. You can't buy organization. A lot of those votes are people talking to each other. It's really old-fashioned town meeting democracy. And people who are committed to a particular candidate sell that candidate to their friends and neighbors. He didn't have that. Secondly, I think there was a real reaction against how negative his campaign was, that he was really running what seemed like a very clever double campaign, you know, hope, optimism, a forward-looking talk on the stump with all these negative ads on television. I think that hurt him. And I think the third thing is that every time you've tested the flat tax in a political campaign, the more voters know about it, the less they like it. In New York, Bill Clinton killed Jerry Brown in the 92 primaries by running against the flat tax, because it's very hard to have a flat tax that doesn't cut taxes for the rich and raise taxes on the heart of the middle class, not even on the poor, but on the heart of the middle class and the upper middle class. And it either does that or balloons the deficit. And I think that message started to get through.
What do you think is the real importance of the Iowa caucuses? Everybody's focusing on it and analyzing it today, but how much does it really tell us?
Well, I think it's important for Phil Graham, because I think it's going to be very hard after losing Louisiana and Iowa for him to make a plausible case that he's got a chance to win, which is something that primary voters in this strange process of ours start to think about. As I say, I think the low turnout is something that Republicans ought to spend a lot of time thinking about. I think Bob Dole is happy to have squeezed by, especially since two or three weeks ago people were saying, gee, he might lose this to Steve Forbes. But I think the next week is going to be a very hard week for Bob Dole. Poor Bob Dole always has very hard weeks once he gets up to New Hampshire. And I think that what's going to happen is that a lot of New Hampshire Republicans who don't particularly like Buchanan and want to win the election are going to start weighing Alexander in more seriously than they did. Alexander becomes this time around what Gary Hart was against Walter Mondale. He seems to be the candidate with the best chance of winning as the alternative to Dole. And I think that's got to worry Dole, because I think it's hard to get a handle on Alexander and attack him, because there's nothing much about him that's offensive to Republicans.
Political columnist for The Washington Post, E.J. Dionne, is my guest. He's the author of Why Americans Hate Politics and a new book called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne. In your new book, you write about a large group of voters that you call the anxious middle. I want you to describe who they are and why you've named them thus.
Well, I should say, in fairness to the good people who have taught me a lot, the anxious middle is in part a marriage of two formulations. One is Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who talks a lot about the anxious class, a group of people out in the country who are basically middle class in their attitudes and in their standard of living, who are deeply worried about watching their prospects sink in this new economy of ours, variously described as global or high technology. The middle part comes from a formulation by my colleague Joe Klein over at Newsweek, who talks about the radical middle. And I think that those two formulations together really tell you a lot about what's going on at the heart of American politics, that you have a whole group of people who are worried about their economic state, who are worried about the country's moral state, not in a narrow sort of sense about trying to impose moral values on people, but just sort of what do we stand for? What are the rewards for hard work? How are my kids going to make it through both a hard economic situation and a time when the values parents want to pass along to their kids seem threatened? These voters are ready to swing all over the lot because they are troubled and unhappy. And in 1992, they helped elect Bill Clinton and helped give Ross Perot a big vote. And in 1994, they were very disappointed by what the Democrats did. I think what's important to see about the movement in American politics in the last 3 years is that it's not about a move to the right. And that's one of the core arguments of my book, is that it's a real mistake to view this in those kind of ideological terms. The Democrats ran in 1992 with their own contract with America. They were basically promising health care reform, meaning trying to find ways to make sure everybody has health insurance, welfare reform, which is to find a way to be generous to the poor, but also to help poor people move into work, political reform to reduce the impact of special interest money on politics, and an effort to use education and job training to ease people's transition to the new economy. If you look at what happened in the 1993-94 Congress, Democrats just didn't deliver any of those things. Healthcare reform died, welfare reform died, political reform died, and all those nice job training and education initiatives didn't get funded very much. And so I think when you looked at what the voters did in 94, this was the anxious middle saying, you didn't do what you promised, we're going to vote Republican. But they weren't looking for a right-wing revolution. They were looking for government that worked, and they still haven't found it.
Now, a concern of yours is that this group that you refer to as the anxious middle, which has the potential of being radicalized, also has the potential to vote for leaders with an authoritarian tinge. Why do you think that has the potential of happening?
When people are frustrated, they can do all sorts of things. I mean, if you go back to the fight over Prop 187 in California, I think, which was about immigration and restricting government aid to illegal immigrants. I think a lot of people who voted for Prop 187, partly they were just concerned that the federal government wasn't controlling the borders. Partly it was an expression of frustration that the California economy had gone through such a terrible period, and it was their way of sending a message. Pat Buchanan is very smart in the way he uses immigration to tap into the anger out there. He uses affirmative action to tap into his opposition to affirmative action to tap into that anger. And that I think if voters are continually frustrated at government's ability to solve problems, they will reach for whatever lever is at hand to express their anger. That's why Ross Perot did so well. He was a choice completely out of the mainstream, and voters were willing to take a chance on this person whom they really didn't know very well. And even after he showed himself to be, less than the sort of calmest, steadiest person in the world at the end of that campaign, a lot of people were still willing to say, I just want to tell these guys I am really angry. That feeling is still out there, and it can go in a lot of directions.
So you think that when voters look for a strong political leader who can fix things, that instinct can sometimes lead to voting for somebody with an authoritarian strain?
It can be. Now, I think it's important that in the United States, our history, partly I think because of the strength of our progressive tradition, our history has been that we always turn away from that. You know, that when the Soviet Union had Stalin, and when Germany had Hitler, and when Spain had Franco, we had Franklin Roosevelt. We were the country in this period of Great Depression, huge economic distress. We were the country that kept its head, and that we saved democracy, partly because we saved it at home first. And I think that in the end, the radical democratic streak in Americans is usually triumphs over any sort of authoritarian streak. And I guess one of the reasons I express a lot of frustration in my book with liberals and Democrats is because I think it's their job to find ways of answering this frustration by using what power government does have to ease this very difficult transition period. And I think one of the mistakes liberals have made over the years is that they've forgotten what liberalism in America, and I don't use progressive to avoid the word liberal, I think liberal is a good word, but what they've done is they've forgotten that you don't use government for the sake of government, you don't use government to expand government. We've used government to enhance the possibilities of individuals to achieve greater self-reliance. Essentially, government in the United States has always helped people to reach a point where they could do without help. And that's what the message of progressivism ought to be. You know, in programmatic terms, it's things like the GI Bill, which helped millions of people go to college. It's student loans, which actually were passed under a Republican president that helped me and lots of other people go to college. Government can step in and make people's lives better by making them, in a sense, freer. I think we've completely forgotten that role for government in all of these polemics against big government.
Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne is my guest. Your new book is called They Only Look Dead: Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Before I ask you why you think progressives will dominate the next political era, who do you mean when you use the word progressives?
Well, one of the things I don't mean is to use progressive as a way of avoiding the word liberal. Sometimes I think progressive is what liberals call themselves after they look at the polls. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the word liberal or with a liberal tradition. But I use the word progressive specifically to define what I think is actually the strongest strain in our political life over the last 100 years. It's a progressivism that goes back to Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and included Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and even involved an awful lot of other more moderate Republican figures. If you look at Dwight Eisenhower, he used government in a way Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt would be proud of, with the student loan program and the interstate highway system, which led to an awful lot of public investment in the economy. I think what's happened is that the new Republican majority in Congress is not simply interested in cutting back government here or there. I think they are really seriously interested in rolling back the whole progressive tradition and going back to a kind of 19th century approach that would have minimal government involvement, minimal government protections for people. Now, they obviously have great trouble getting there. And why did they run into trouble in the last Congress? They ran into trouble in the last Congress because Americans in their hearts are still, I think, progressive. Progressive in the sense that they haven't given up on government's capacities. They haven't given up on the idea that it isn't a bad thing for government to provide health insurance for our parents and grandparents and poor kids and the like. And so when these issues were actually joined in a practical way, as against a rhetorical way, the country said, no, that's not what we're really for. And that's why I think this progressive strain is strong and will come back on the upswing because we've started joining the argument in a real way, in a way we hadn't. And that, I think, is what's changed since Why Americans Hate Politics, is that I think the argument now has the potential of becoming much more real than it was when I wrote that earlier book.
Well, do you see anybody in politics now who embodies the argument that you're making?
No, I see pieces of it. Clinton does it sometimes. President Clinton does it sometimes. Senator Bill Bradley does it sometimes. Those are probably the two people I think of most. But I think a lot of the sort of younger Democrats and some of the progressive Republicans who are trying to figure out where do they really stand vis-a-vis this Gingrich revolution, that there are a lot of people out there who are saying we want to turn away from the debate we've had for the last year because we know that voters are turned off by it. And one of the things I try to talk about a lot in the book is the importance of seeing progressivism as a bipartisan tradition. I don't expect progressivism to become dominant in the Republican Party. What I do expect is a lot of Republicans who still carry those ideas and feelings to have to make a choice now that they didn't feel they had to make until now. And when you look at a vote on the environmental issues, 50 Republicans have steadily defected to the Democratic side, if you will, because they said, no, environmentalism is in the tradition of our own party. That's Teddy Roosevelt's tradition. We don't want to give up on that. And so I think a lot of people are being sort of called, their consciences are being challenged in this period. And I think that's going to be good for us in the long run.
E.J. Dionne is a political columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Nancy Sinatra on her hits and her boots. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews I'm With Stupid, the new release by Amy Mann. And we continue our conversation with Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne. He's the author of the book, Why Americans Hate Politics. In his new book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era, he argues that Democrats can either revitalize their party for the next century or watch as their party collapses into incoherence and irrelevance. You write in your book that you think liberals made a mistake by allowing themselves to be seen as defending the status quo.
Right. Well, I think that liberals are supposed to be the party of reform. That is, when people voted for liberal candidates, they were always voting for reform. And they were also always voting, I think, or mostly voting for an experimental approach to government. One of FDR's most famous lines was a call for bold, persistent experimentation and to try something, and if it didn't work, to try something else. I think liberals painted themselves, and also their conservatives were very effective in painting them as defenders of whatever old program they had established in the past. And I think one of the mistakes the Clinton administration made was in not trying to link up Vice President Gore's reinventing government project to its broader purposes. Because what Gore was really doing there is saying, look, Democrats, liberals, progressives, people who favor active government also understand that you can't necessarily do everything the same way all the time over a 50-year period, that there are some programs that need to be junked and other programs that need to be reshaped. I mean, the most, in terms of sort of progressive orthodoxy, the most heretical notion I have in the book is that I don't think that liberals ought to be opposed to experiments with school vouchers in the poorest neighborhoods of our country. If the public schools in very poor neighborhoods are really awful and parents want to look for alternatives, I don't think liberals should be standing in the way of that. Vouchers are not an alternative to public education. They shouldn't be used to destroy public education. But why not do some experiments? I think a kind of experimental approach to liberalism is what makes people turn to liberals in times of crisis.
A few years ago, you wrote a book called Why Americans Hate Politics, a title that had, I think, a lot of resonance.
It was my wife's brilliant idea, and I always want to credit her for it.
Well, good. And in that book, you wrote that politics right now is framing the political debate with a series of false choices. Do you think that we still are confronted with these false choices?
I think liberals and progressives have been much too wary in trying to join the moral debate and in saying that the choice before us is not between the Christian Coalition and Pat Robertson on the one side or a complete indifference to the coarsening of our culture on the other side. Most people don't want either of those choices. Most Americans are tolerant, reasonably tolerant, open-minded. They're also we are also the most religious country in the world. We care a lot about God and family and our children, and that we ought to be able to find a way of talking about these issues that doesn't seem to cast out a huge chunk of our country. And I think we also have to figure out how to talk about these issues in a way that says that morality is not just about sort of the bedroom issues that we are always seem to be obsessed with. It's also about what kind of rewards are people going to get for living a decent life. If people work hard and they worry about their neighbors and their communities and they try to raise their kids, for them, for those people, the central moral issue is this approach to life, which I believe to be the moral approach, Is this going to get rewarded in our society, or are we going to get run over? I think that's what a lot of those folks feel, and that's how we need to broaden the moral debate. So in that sense, I still think we need to wage a war on a certain kind of false choice that's out there.
In your book, Why Americans Hate Politics, you offered one reason as being the trivialization of American politics and, you know, Americans' frustration with that trivialization. Do you think we still face that?
Well, we sure did in the Iowa caucuses and we do in the advertising in the New Hampshire primary. I think part of the problem is that Republicans for a long time ran against government without trying to cut government back, which is why we got the deficit. And while I disagree with a lot of the choices this Republican Congress made, at least they had the guts finally to say, we got to stop doing that. We've got to start making some real choices if we're going to talk about this small government stuff. I think the problem is a lot of Americans don't necessarily like the choices they made. On the other side, Democrats often tried to pretend, oh, we're really just as anti-government as the Republicans are. We're just sort of nicer about it. And I think Democrats really fall down on their job when they fail to sort of stand up and say, no, we don't think government can do everything, but we do think government has a legitimate role in American life. When you have both parties kind of engaging in this politics of evasion, as somebody once called it, people get cynical. When people get cynical, the advertising gets more cynical to appeal to a cynical electorate, and we end up having ads that drive down turnout. I think when we talked once before, I said that I'm amazed by political advertising because if the advertising we had for food products were like the advertising we had for candidates, we'd all lose a lot of weight because we wouldn't eat anything. If one apple manufacturer said about the other what Steve Forbes says about Bob Dole.
Are there things that you think you can bring to the American political debate as a columnist that you couldn't as a reporter?
That's a wonderful question, and sometimes I don't even like to face the question, I think. I think, you know, the good thing about being a columnist is that you can have sort of complete truth in labeling. You know, the people who read you regularly, and even the people who read you occasionally, know where you're coming from, so they can put what you're saying in a context, and, you know, if they think they disagree with your whole worldview, they'll put what you say in one context, and if they agree with you, they'll put it in another. And I think there's a great advantage to that in being able to just make arguments in that way. On the other side, there's still part of me that tugs me back to old-fashioned reporting. I think that there is a problem in our culture and in the journalistic culture, or the media culture, really, right now, of clashing opinions without facts. That we treat opinions as having the same value as facts. We allow people to toss out almost anything and, well, say that's just another point of view. Well, there are some things that are true and there are some things that are not true. And one of the good things about good old-fashioned journalism, and I hope we don't lose it in this culture of clashing opinions, is that we better worry about whether these opinions are based on things that are true or whether they simply come out of thin air or based on falsehoods. And I think there's a danger here.
Well, E.J. Dionne, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, this is a great pleasure.
E.J. Dionne is a political columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Coming up, Nancy Sinatra. This is Fresh Air. When Frank Sinatra turned 80, we spoke briefly about him with his daughter, Nancy. We're going to hear more from Nancy Sinatra, this time about her own recording career. She's best known for hits like These Boots Are Made for Walkin' and How Does That Grab You, Darling, in which she put across a pretty tough image. But her earlier records were bubblegum productions overseen by Annette Funicello's music director. They did okay overseas, but bombed in the States. In fact, her label, Reprise, was getting ready to dump her, even though the label was founded by her father. Reprise was willing to give her one more chance in 1965, and with some help, she changed her image and her luck.
Jimmy Bowen, who was head of A&R at Reprise, put me with a guy named Lee Hazelwood. Lee had approached Jimmy, unbeknownst to me. He said, I can get her a chart record in this country, and if I don't get her a chart record in this country, you can tell me to leave. And he said, I promise a chart record the first time out. And he delivered. It was called So Long, Babe, and it barely made the charts, but it made the charts. During that session, he said to me, you can't sing like Nancy Nicelady anymore. You have to sing for the truckers. At about this time, I was getting a divorce. My husband decided he didn't want to have children, and I did, and he knew it. So we split. And Lee said to me, you've been married, and now you're divorced, and people know that. So let's lose this virgin image. Let's get rid of it. And we did that, and we lowered the key. We dropped my voice down where it belonged, again, where I was more comfortable early on in the more R&B type things.
Let's hear These Boots Are Made for Walking from a recent collection of your greatest hits on Rhino Records.
Okay.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Nancy Sinatra is my guest. Did your whole image change after this record came out? The way you dressed, what your public persona?
You know, again, timing is everything in life. I had been on tour in Europe. I brought home from Carnaby Street the miniskirt. And I wasn't crazy about the way my legs looked in the miniskirt, so I put on a pair of boots. I wore that around. It became my favorite thing to wear. I wore it to the dance clubs that I went to.
I must up you right here. Were they white boots?
No, they weren't. Actually, they were kind of a camely brown color.
Uh-huh.
And I people would make fun of me saying, well, what are you going to play, tennis or what? You know, because the miniskirt was not a staple the way it is now. As a matter of fact, it wasn't seen at all, you know?
Now, a little later on, you recorded a duet with your father, Something Stupid. One thing that's always interested me about this record is that it's a song sung from the perspective of two lovers, but you were singing it as father and daughter. Was that a slightly awkward thing to do?
No, it was a very natural thing to do, but the disc jockeys dubbed it the incest song.
Oh, really?
At the time, which I think probably added to it in a way. You know, it gave them something fun to kid about. Now recording it, there are different ways to love people, I think, you know.
Was it daunting to record a duet with your father, or were you relaxed about it?
I was very relaxed about it. I had a certain number of hits of my own, and the scary part, though, was coming in when at the end of the session that they were doing that night with Jobim.
Oh, that's the date he recorded with Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It was one of the sessions for that album, the first of their albums.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, coming in with my little... I called us the B team. Coming in with the B team and watching the A team in action, I was it was enthralling. And I don't like this word, but awesome, you know. And then, of course, the A team moved over and the little B team took over, Lee Hazelwood, Jimmy Bowen, Billy Strange, and our rhythm section. And we cut a number one song.
Yeah, you delivered.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear it? This is my guest, Nancy Sinatra, and her father, Frank Sinatra.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you despise the same old lies you heard the night before.
My guess is Nancy Sinatra, and she's written a new book about her father. You know, you're making something of a comeback now. You have a recent new CD, a greatest hit CD. You have the new book. What's the occasion for your getting back into performing?
When my husband died in 1985, I decided I'd better become full-time mom because my daughters, then 9 and 11, would have been virtually parentless. So I stopped doing anything that involved traveling. It was important to me to do that right, you know, to be there at 3 o'clock whenever possible when they got out of school, make breakfast in the morning. I became a Brownie troop leader, PTA member. I really did the whole thing as best I could. Then my kids really left me. As kids are wont to do. They both went into college, and I found myself with the empty nest syndrome, that corny thing. And I said, I've got to get back to work. It's time now. I've done what I was supposed to do, and now it's my turn. So that's what happened.
Does it feel different in your 50s to sing These Boots Are Made for Walking than it did in your 20s?
Yeah, it does. And it mostly because of the clothes.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's I'm walking this weird line. I'm trying to be age appropriate, but at the same time, age appropriate is...
Was getting redefined.
It is getting redefined. We're kind of changing the face of 50 and... And 60 and 70 and 80. I look at my dad, who's turning 80. I can't believe it.
I saw you posed naked for Playboy.
Yes.
I haven't seen the picture, but why did you do it?
When I decided that it was time to get back to work,
mm-hmm.
I realized that it was a lot more competitive out there than it had been when I left. And I needed a good, shocking promotional tool. The miniskirt in the 60s was the tool then. The miniskirt made that fashion statement, along with the boots. I needed that kind of a thing, and I didn't know in the 90s what there was available. My publicist said to me, what about Playboy? And I said, oh, no, never, not a chance. There's no way I could ever do that. I mean, I wouldn't do it in my 20s. Why would I do it in my 50s? He said, well, it's a tool. I said, but you know, I sure would like them to shoot the pictures for the album. I was doing a new album at the time called One More Time. And he said, well, let me see if I can set it up. And I met with Marilyn Grabowski, who's the West Coast photo editor for Playboy, and Stephen Wada, the photographer that they had chosen to work with me. We decided what we were going to do for the album. And Marilyn said, why don't we do a pictorial? I said, I don't think so. And she said, Nancy, if you don't like the pictures, she said, you look great. If you don't like the pictures, you can take them home and burn them or whatever else you want to do with them. So I said, well, Stephen, you better take a look at me first. So Stephen and the makeup lady and I went into a private kind of a room in the Playboy studio. And I did my little strip, and he said, I think you look great. He said, let's do it. So we went back in with Marilyn, and I said, can I really get rid of the pictures if I don't like them? She said, yes. I said, okay.
But you like the pictures?
The pictures were wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful. And this was before any airbrushing or retouching. And I was just, you know, I was torn. And I thought, would this offend anybody? Would this possibly be offensive to my family, first of all, my children, of course?
Mm-hmm.
And I checked with them, and they both said, why don't you go for it, Mom? It's probably a good idea.
So did it do what it wanted, what you wanted it to do?
Absolutely. That and more.
Did your father give you his blessing?
Not exactly, no. No, it was more get more money for it. You know, get more money. But he understood the reasons, and that I appreciated that.
Nancy Sinatra, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I've really enjoyed this.
I have too, thank you. And Nancy Sinatra has a new book about her father, and it's called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's been 3 years since Amy Mann released an album. Her new one is called I'm With Stupid. During that time, Mann was a victim of the music business. The label that released her 1993 collection, Whatever, went out of business, but it still had her under contract. And although Mann had completed I'm With Stupid for release in early 1995, only now has the legal path been cleared. Here's rock critic Ken Tucker with a review.
It's a measure of Amy Mann's vivid, varied talent that there's nothing on her new album, I'm With Stupid, that sounds stale or dated. In fact, in recent interviews, Mann has been joking that she's glad this collection wasn't released when it was supposed to have been, because its angry love songs would have had to compete with those of that new avatar of female anger, Alanis Morissette. But with Morissette, there's the feeling that she's relishing the pain and abuse she's inflicting on someone who's hurt her. Revenge matters. The more mature Amy Mann finds revenge irrelevant on I'm With Stupid. She's also remarked recently that, quote, if this album has a basic text, it's something like this, you're a nightmare, I'm not going to get involved with you, so go away, unquote. To which I can only add, well, right on.
So
When Amy Mann emerged in the mid-80s as the singer and bassist for the Boston band Till Tuesday, it was her voice that immediately distinguished the group, a slightly flat, slightly quavering, yet completely self-aware, intelligent tone that doesn't have to be raised in volume to convince you of its vehemence.
You look the part of the poor brave martyr, and guess who broke your heart? Luetta Hazelwood, sugar-coated. When they wrote it, I would have believed it too. I would have believed it too. I would believe that I'm so relentless, and you're defenseless until the pencil stops. You'll be the one who's sugar-coated, overloaded. Do you believe it's true? Do you believe it's true? Do you believe it?
With Till Tuesday and on her first solo album, Whatever, Mann frequently strove to make her prickly, personal lyrics intricate and clever. Not for nothing did she find a kindred spirit in Elvis Costello, who wrote songs for her just to hear her voice singing his own intricate words. But one of the things I like most about I'm With Stupid is that Mann is just as interested in making the music take turns as twisty and artful as the lyrics. One nice thing about this album, as far as its commercial prospects are concerned, is that it fits right in with what's in the air right now. Rather than the more assiduous homages to the Beatles and the Kinks that frequently characterize Till Tuesday's music, Amy Mann's solo work can be heard as more of a commentary on 60s and 70s pop, as a series of strategies designed to yield originality without trashing the past. It's a sensibility that keeps Mann's work fresh and urgent, no matter how much time it takes her to release a record.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
I don't know if I'm Adam, you could make my day. If you leave me a message, I'll give it away. 'Cause I'm almost perfect strangers that you can talk to. All the ones who pretend that you're not really you. Oh, and any attempts here to play Frankenstein come with plenty of chances for changing your mind. When you're building your own creation, nothing's better than real, than a real imitation. When the gun in the first act goes off in the third, 'cause it's rare that you ever...
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.